This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Andrew Holleran has been a puzzling figure in the world of gay literature. He first became known for his acclaimed 1978 novel, Dancer from the Dance, about New York's gay nightlife before the AIDS epidemic. He's chronicled life during the AIDS era in his perceptive essays published in the gay paper Christopher Street and in his book of essays, Ground Zero. But here's the puzzling part. Holleran never came out to his own parents. In fact, the name Andrew Holleran is a pseudonym he's used to help keep the secret. His new novel may help explain why. Titled The Beauty of Men, it's about a 50-year-old man who has left Manhattan and returned home to Florida to care for his mother, who has become paralyzed after an accidental fall. He's never told her that he's gay and keeps that part of his life hidden from her even as she dies in a nursing home. Here's a reading from The Beauty of Men, in which the main character, Lark, faces his mother's slow death in a nursing home while he deals with the loss of friends to AIDS.
It's odd that this should have happened almost simultaneously with the onslaught of AIDS, two parallel disasters occurring in the separate compartments of his life. His friends dying in New York, his mother paralyzed down here. There are various theories to explain it. His cousin said, weeping, that his mother's accident had taken him out of New York and saved him from the plague. Sutcliffe told him he was there only to hide from the horror. Another friend, in therapy in San Francisco, told him his mother had fallen in order to keep him by her side out of the world of men. The fact is, two things happened for quite different reasons. Eddie and all who followed acquired a virus. His mother tripped on a rug. In the meantime, he has come to realize that whether or not he ever sees the connection between these two forms of suffering, these two disasters, life will not wait till he achieves his understanding. And that while he may feel time has stopped, it hasn't. In fact, it's only when he walks through the door of the nursing home and sees the faces of the octogenarians in the wheelchairs all turn, like men in a gay bar, to see who's come in, that he feels what he used to when he walked into the Melody Club, young.
That's an excerpt from Andrew Holleran's new novel, The Beauty of Men. Now, you took care of your mother when she was sick, I believe?
Mm-hmm.
And what did she have in the novel?
Well, it's basically, yeah. The novel is a strange mix of the pretty factual and the made up. And I think when I started writing it that I was writing kind of almost a diary as a relief for myself. I was in a situation I had never been in before. I was in a nursing home and I was seeing, you know, images and people and things that most of us don't see unless you have to go into a nursing home. And I was so struck with all of it that I began writing it down. And most of the nursing home stuff, I think, my mother's situation, her quadriplegia, is pretty factual. And a little bit is made up. But I think the core of the novel, the nursing home scenes, are all pretty much as they happened.
And you were living a double life like your character is.
Absolutely, yeah. I was living in New York. It was 1983. AIDS had just begun. My friend Eddie was one of the first people I knew in the whole city, as far as I remember, to be sick. It was my 39th birthday. I had gone down to my parents' town in Florida on a visit, and I remember thinking when I went there that time that I was only going to spend 10 days there, that I couldn't waste any more time in this little town, that, you know, it was just too dull. And halfway through that visit, my parents were away on a trip. I got a phone call saying that my mother had fallen and had broken her neck. And that began the great change. That's when I left New York, basically, and ended up living in Florida, in that town. And meanwhile, Eddie got sicker and died, and he was the first of many, many other people. So I was living those years, which is what this book is really about, those difficult years, the 80s, on two levels, I guess, two separate things, as I just read in that passage, two parallel disasters.
Tell us a little bit about the life you came from in New York.
It was the life that's basically written about in my first novel, Dancer from the Dance. It had kind of ended before 1983. Things were changing a great deal. New generations were coming in, and I was going through, I think, the natural process of middle age then, of withdrawing from things you had done when you were, you know, in your 20s. But the thing that really took over from that was AIDS. And so the life that's described in Dancer from the Dance, which ended for me in about 1981, 82, was ended, you know, doubly by what happened with AIDS.
And it's a life of nightlife and bars and...
It's exactly. It was the same life, I think, that's being led in New York right now. I think all of that's still going on. I think it's been recreated. There's a party circuit that's even more intense than the one that I participated in when I was, you know, in the 70s. The party circuit then used to be simply going around to different clubs in New York and Fire Island, and now it involves going to the Black and Blue Ball in Montreal, going to the White Party in Miami, going to... You know, more things. It seems more intense on one level, but again, it's got this big difference, and that is AIDS.
Now, the life that you moved to when your mother was paralyzed was, in a lot of ways, exactly the opposite of the life that you had in New York. I mean, it was not a life of nightlife and of parties and
no,
so on. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a life of Murder, She Wrote, and Jeopardy, and Wheel of Fortune. And it was absolutely two different worlds, completely separate, yeah. And I would say that my novel is basically about that kind of difficulty in integrating the two. The fact that gay life, in some cases, results in a schizophrenia, a kind of splitting for some people.
Well, the kind of splitting that happened in your life happened in part because I believe you never told your mother you were gay.
Right, and that's a scene in the novel, I think the current one, The Beauty of Men. Toward the end of the book, she asks him, and he can't say it, he can't tell her. And it's part of the whole, I think, paralysis of the book that goes beyond hers. That's a kind of paralysis, too.
Did that happen to you? Did your mother, before she died, say to you, well,
absolutely.
Are you gay?
Yes, absolutely. And this book is not, you know, a politically correct poster child for how one should be gay. The thing about fiction, I think, that's wonderful is that you can put down all sorts of things that aren't perfect, that aren't ideal, but to me are the human reality, and I used that as part of it.
So what did you say to your mother when she asked you?
I think it's in the book. I think he reviews all the occasions when he was asked, and in every occasion, he simply finessed it. He simply didn't reply. It was one of those things that happens, I think, often in families where it's known, but it's not spoken, and it's not necessary that it be spoken because it is known. As to why it's not spoken, though, that's fascinating to me, and I don't know the answer.
Well, let's
because
think
obviously
a little
there are people who do speak the words.
Well, let's think a little bit about why you didn't speak the words to your mother. Was it a fear of how it would affect her life?
I think it was a fear of the fact that we were in a very claustrophobic situation. I couldn't predict how it would alter it. And I also think, and I think this is said in the novel, this is ascribed to Mr. Lark, that it's his own feelings about being gay, that it's his problem, not hers. And I think that's a very interesting phenomenon in gay people. You can be forgiven by everybody, if that's the word, but sometimes you can't forgive yourself. In other words, you have your own standards. And if you are ashamed of it, then who cares if the priest, the doctor, the president, your parents, your neighbors all say it's okay. You may have some lingering disagreement with that. This is all speculation. You know, I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but that's kind of my take on it.
Are you saying that you still are uncomfortable with being gay?
Exactly. That's the only thing I could conclude. I mean, why didn't I say yes? I'm comfortable with it in many, many, many ways. I've lived, you know, as a gay person, and it's not a problem. And I would never deny it. But at that moment, I did. So I asked myself, why? And that's my only hypothesis. But it may be totally wrong, I don't know.
Right. Had you played out the scenarios of, like, what if I told my mother I was gay? How would it change my life? How would it change her life?
Yeah, and the torture, of course, is the torture of these situations is you do it after the person dies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the worst part.
Well, how did the scenarios play out when you did this imaginary thing?
You know, it's funny because I think I guess my response was the correct one because when I tried to imagine the scenario in which I had said I was, I couldn't follow it up with anything after that. I couldn't imagine how it would have changed anything. And this is often a phenomenon, I think, I've heard friends talk about, that it is spoken, it is admitted, and then it's never referred to again. I don't know, though. You know, you have to give people a lot of credit. There are a lot of people who are perfectly intelligent, perfectly willing to accept the fact, perfectly willing to integrate it into their own lives. And the trouble with life is you have no idea which ones they are. I came out to my sister, for example, years ago, and we both decided that I shouldn't come out to my father, for example. And my mother, I'm sure, did know. And I'm sure that my case is very, very common and that there's, you know, there's partial comings out in a lot of families. And frankly, I think that's what makes families wonderful. I think that there's a lot of, if there's love in a family and there's consideration for one another and there's the best interests at heart of the individual members for the others, I think this is really almost an academic issue. I think that people know and they know as much as they want to know, and that's that.
Now, have you been criticized a lot by gay friends and other gay writers for not having come out to your family? I mean, it's part of the gay ethic, in a way, to come out of the closet.
I agree with you. And I had to write an article for Wigwag, a magazine that existed a few years ago, on the question of outing people. And when I had finished it, I thought that I had come out against it and said that it was, you know, a violation of privacy and it's a person's individual right to do what he wants with that information. And my editor called me up and he thought I had come out for it. So it's one of those things where I find it a total paradox. If there's nothing wrong with being gay, then there's nothing wrong with being known to be gay. But in real life, once again, to go back to this, I think we're all kind of much more a mess about this. It's not as clear cut. And as far as being criticized by friends, I don't think so. I'm not. If I were really afraid to talk about this, I wouldn't be talking about it now. If I really thought it was a terrible thing, I wouldn't even be discussing it. I'd be hiding it from other people, gay people, but I'm not. I mean, I think it's just a human situation, and I don't think I'm alone in this, and I'm not pretending to be a saint. I admire people who are strictly down the line trying to bring homosexuals out into the public arena, but it's a partial process, and some of us, you know, are lagging behind and doing it halfway or three quarters of the way.
Andrew Holleran is my guest, and his new novel is called The Beauty of Men. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Andrew Holleran, and his novels include Dancer from the Dance and Nights in Aruba. His new novel is called The Beauty of Men. Andrew Holleran is not your real name. It's a pen name that you've been using throughout your writing career. Why did you take a pen name?
I took a pen name because one day in 1978, shortly before Dancer came out, I was on the phone with my editor, and this ties in with what we were talking about. I said to her, "I don't care at all who knows I'm gay," I said, "but I would hate to have the wrong people in the little town, you know, my family's living, and use it against them in some way." And she said to me, "Well, the wrong people are always the first to get a book," she said, "so if you feel that way, you should take a pen name." So I had till 5 o'clock that afternoon to come up with a pen name, and I did.
How'd you come up with Andrew Holleran?
I went to school with someone with a very interesting name, and I took his last name and changed the first one. But that's it. No significance to it other than that.
Is the small town that you're from in Florida a town that has a lot of fundamentalist people who would have biblical objections to homosexuality?
Yes. Like everything in Florida right now, it's in this incredible mix of cultures. There's Christian radio stations in my town who broadcast Focus on the Family things. There are a lot of churches. One of the things I love to do in my book was just take the signs, the slogans off the signs that churches put up outside. You stand tall when you kneel to Jesus. In the opening chapter of my book, there is graffiti on the wall of the men's room. In between the sexual stuff, somebody had written, "Jesus loves you." So Florida's this incredible collision of the two cultures, of the rural fundamentalist Baptist often culture, and really the Northeast moving down there, and people who are sophisticated and agnostic and completely urban.
Now, you're a writer, and just about all your writing has had to do with homosexuality in one way or another. I mean, the characters are gay, the themes relate to gay life. And I wonder what your mother thought you did with your time, because you couldn't tell her that you wrote, because then you'd have to show her something, but what you showed her would be gay-related. So, what did she imagine you did with your time?
Well, that was one of the poignant things, I think, that she knew I wrote. I told her about the books as they came out. I told her I'd published a book and stuff. She often asked me to give the books to nurses and aides at the nursing home who knew I was a writer. And to be quite honest, that was incredibly sad for me.
What did you do? Not give it to them, I'd imagine.
Exactly, exactly.
And what?
That was extremely sad, but that was also an example of the, I guess, the unspoken love that I wasn't pushed, I wasn't harassed for it. It was requested, I didn't do it, that was accepted, and that was that. But sure, I regret it.
What explanation did you give?
Oh, I think if you say no to someone, and you're often not pressed. I guess I came from a family that was very tolerant in that way and was very considerate in that way. You were not harassed. I wasn't forced to give the books.
There's just so many paradoxes in our conversation because you were calling your family so tolerant, and yet obviously
I get what you're saying.
You know, obviously you felt that they wouldn't tolerate your homosexuality.
And
you know,
exactly. You're saying
it's just,
that it's
everything's
actually
really coded.
Yeah, right. I know, and you're saying that it was an incredibly manipulative and controlling kind of
exactly
of
right. Yeah, that's a possibility. Yeah,
right. That's a possibility, sure. And and I could look at it that way, I suppose, and perhaps one day I'll alter my view. But at the moment, I just didn't feel it at the time that way. I just thought, there's something here that is genuinely irreconcilable. I think one of the reasons I wrote the book, in fact, was I wanted to present that fact, that in life there are problems for which there is simply as Americans, I think we have this progressive, problem-solving, optimistic, basically, mentality that things can be solved and there is a solution and there is a happy ending. And I felt very guilty about writing a book which doesn't have a happy ending. But
oh, not
that's
only
what
that,
this book
yeah.
is about.
Well, may I add here that, you know, so often the deathbed scene is a time where, you know, people come clean and speak openly about things they hadn't spoken before and reconcile mm-hmm. and so on. And that...
Didn't happen.
Right.
I mean,
there was still plenty of love there between the mm-hmm. mother and son, but not complete honesty, obviously.
Yeah. But again, I think the honesty was there. I think that you can mm-hmm. have the talk without having the talk.
Right, right.
That you don't have to have the formal statement.
Let me ask you, when your mother died a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. did you undergo a personal transformation yourself because you no longer had to live a double life?
No, it was worse. It's much worse, I think. To me, the book begins where the book ends. I have this feeling that the book ends with Lark sitting in the parking lot in that car. And I think the scales finally have fallen from his eyes about Becker, about the mother, about his life. And to me, that's where the story almost begins. It's like that lady and the dog story in Chekhov with that last line where you realize he says that, and now all the difficulties started. I think when you go through a change like that, a tremendous life change like that, you view everything differently. And that hasn't played itself out yet, but I know it's happened and I just don't know where it's going to go.
So did you move back to New York?
Haven't done any of those things. I've watched friends. I've not been the only one in this situation. I found that that other gay people have gone through what I've gone through. Friends of mine whom I met down there, actually, straight and gay, moved down from New York to care for ailing parents. The parents died, and they're stranded down there. They can't go back. Their former life is kind of not in play anymore, and they have to start over. And I've watched them try different things. I've watched them flounder in a way. And while I think of myself as benefiting from having watched other people go through this, it's really no way to avoid it yourself. I think one has to flounder, and one will go through a lot of false starts and come out at the other end eventually, but I don't know when it will be.
So what do you see for yourself in the next few years? What kind of life do you want to have, and where do you want to have it?
It's a total blank. It's a total blank. I'm in an almost odd Jamesian situation where I'm free to do what I want, but the question becomes, Is that liberating or is that paralyzing to
mm-hmm.
be free?
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea. You know, as you age, though, you get to questions of meaning, I think. one of the things about Lark at the end is that he hasn't had to ask any questions, really, because he's been preoccupied. And I think that as you age, if you're fortunate enough to age, if you're fortunate enough to get to the point where you can ask questions about what did you do with your life, what should you have done with your life, what do you want to do with your life with the time remaining, those questions become things that will lead you to answers, I think. And one of the tragedies I've always thought about AIDS, in a way, was that it upsets me to think of friends of mine who had to end their lives in that way without ever being able to answer any questions or get to the point of saying, this is what I did with my life, this is what I wanted to do with it. I've always thought that AIDS was kind of getting a bum's rush at the end, where you couldn't handle your life's ending the way you wanted to. It was taken out of your hands to a degree, although that too varied from case to case.
Mm-hmm. Well, Andrew Holleran, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Andrew Holleran's new novel is called The Beauty of Men. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.